reached the mainland and got on I-95 North, then got off again at the first service area. There's only a few things I like as much as driving, and one of them is an afternoon nap. I curled up on the Route 66 couch and sawed off some Z's for the better part of the afternoon. I woke up and fixed a cold ham and cheese sandwich and washed it down with an ice-cold lemonade. I was sitting on Zelda's back porch watching the traffic whiz by when a camper pulling a boat rolled in. One of the tires on the trailer was coming apart. Kawop, 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 kawop. I jumped out of Zelda and tried to wave them down, but they just smiled and waved back. Evidently, they thought I was just being friendly, because they kept smiling and waving back like old friends. Then I realized they were old friends. It was Hank and Gilbert from Valdosta, Georgia, the two retired fishermen I met down on Grassy Key. They piled out, and we engaged in a hearty round of handshakes and backpatting. There's a certain camaraderie out on the road between friends and travelers. In reality, I'd only spoken to these fellows a couple of times, but a person would have thought we were having an old-fashioned family reunion there on the side of the road. Then I pointed out the flat tire and confessed that that was the real reason I'd been waving. That didn't spoil the reunion, though. We all pitched in and jacked up the boat and took off the bad tire, but I realized there was also a bad wheel bearing. It took several hours to chase down the parts we needed, then put the wheel back together. We finished just in time, because there were some serious storm clouds gathering overhead. Hank treated us to the best restaurant around, which was the Burger King in the rest area. Gilbert kept talking about how fortunate they were to find the problem and make the repairs before heading across the Everglades on a narrow two-lane road called Alligator Alley. There was nothing out there but 100 miles of snakes and alligators, not to mention the impending storm. I pulled out of the service area and headed north on I-95, and the retirees headed for Alligator Alley. I looked at the sky and wondered if those good old boys were going to be all right. A couple of hours later, I pulled into a truck stop in Fort Pierce. It was after 10 p.m. I was tired and covered with dirt, axle grease, and sweat, and wanted a bath in the worst way. Most truck stops have showers that are free to truckers that purchase a minimum amount of fuel, which is usually 50 gallons. Zelda only had a 50-gallon tank, so unless I coasted into a truck stop on empty, I could seldom buy the 50 gallons. But so far, every place that I'd stopped had been happy to let me take a free shower. Of course, I always gave them the 50-cent tour of Zelda for free. While I was pumping fuel into the tank, two fuel desk clerks walked by. They were complaining about the night clerk who had just relieved them. I gathered from their conversation that the lazy son of a bitch never did his share of work, and was always complaining about being overworked and underpaid. I finished fueling and went inside to pay and hopefully get a free shower. But the lazy son of a bitch wouldn't let me have a shower, because I'd only purchased 40 gallons of fuel. It's ironic how people who think that the world is shortchanging them are always the first to shortchange someone else. I parked Zelda and took a sponge bath in the sink, making a futile attempt to get rid of the wheel-bearing grease and sweat. A bolt of lightning struck nearby, splitting the sky wide open and pouring out untold amounts of water. So I stepped out into the rain with a bar of soap and scrubbed to my heart's content. After my free shower, I stretched out on the couch and listened to the pellets of water that drummed on Zelda's roof. The sound reminded me of the rain on the tin roof of our old house on Socrum Loop Road. I loved that sound when I was a kid. I tried to stay awake and listen to the wind and pouring rain, but soon I was fast asleep. The next thing I knew, sunlight was pouring in the window. I raised up and peered out, only to see a couple of truck drivers' noses pressed against Zelda's window. Oh, hell, not another bad dream, I thought. I got out of bed and gave the truckers the 50-cent tour of Zelda for free. Lucky for me, they bought a couple of tapes and some T-shirts. After those drivers went on their way, along came some more, and they also bought some tapes. After they left, another wave of drivers showed up, and even a few tourists came around. In less than an hour, my operating capital had swelled to nearly $700. Best of all, I had a fistful of green to prove that it wasn't just another dream. I drove up to Daytona and cruised down the boulevard a few times. Even though I'd spent a lot of time there as a teenager, I hardly recognized the place. The arcades on the boardwalk had disappeared, and the small motels that once lined the beaches had given way to monstrous hotels and condos. Sweat was oozing from my pores like water from a sponge, so I headed down to the beach to cool off in the surf. Daytona is famous for its broad beaches that you can drive on, but an attendant sitting in a toll booth stopped me and insisted that I'd have to pay to drive Zelda on the beach. A toll booth? Pay to get on the beach? I blew off the beach and gave Steve and Laurie a call. We decided to cool off with a motorcycle ride, so we herded the motorcycles north on US 1 towards St. Augustine. We hadn't made 50 miles before the sky dumped buckets of water on us, but no one complained. It felt good to be soaked in something besides sweat. I just tilted my head back, let the cool water run down my face into my mouth, and took advantage of another free shower. The next day was overcast but warm, which was perfect weather for a drive up the coast. I made my way into Georgia and rolled through the low hills and deltas. I spent part of the afternoon in Savannah, exploring the historic seaport on my mountain bike. I took a break outside an English pub and sipped sweet iced tea while watching the freighters glide by on the river. I tried to imagine what it would have been like 100 years ago when wooden ships lined the harbor and sailors and soldiers and southern belles dominated the boardwalk. Savannah was a beautiful place, full of romance and history, but I wasn't in the mood for either, so I put Zelda back in the wind. I motored up the eastern seaboard on I-95 into South Carolina, then trucked northwest on I-26 into North Carolina. A lot of people complain about traveling the interstate, and complain about what the interstate system has done to small-town America, but I'm not one of those people. It's true that many a small town has withered in the shadow of four lanes, which is a disappointing thing to see. On the other hand, before the interstates, those same people whined about the amount of cross-country traffic that thundered through those small towns. And I'm not too young to remember all the wailing about how dangerous those old roads were. Many of them had nicknames like Bloody 27 and Dead Man's Curve or Widowmaker's Grade. I peeled off the big road near Clinton, South Carolina, and turned into an old Phillips 66 station that had survived since the 60s. There was a diesel pump off to the side in a dirt lot, so I idled over the pump and stepped down out of the cab. I noticed an old gray gentleman eyeing Zelda from the rear of his shiny black T-Bird. "What do y'all got in that thing, a race car?" He tipped his cap and wiped the sweat from his brow. "No, sir, just a motorcycle." "A motorcycle? Well, I'll be dipped." He looked back at his wife, who was sitting in the T-Bird, working feverishly at her knitting. "Look at that thing, Mama. That young fella's got himself a motorcycle in that old Peterbilt." She gazed over her bifocals momentarily, then went back to work. "Y'all race 'em?" "No, sir. It's just a toy." "It's just a toy? You sure like big toys. What kind of motorcycle y'all got? I expect it's one of them Harley Davidsons." "Yes, sir." "A Harley Davidson. I could have told you that." He turned back towards the glistening T-Bird and yelled, "It's a toy, Mama. Just a great big toy, and he's got himself one of them Harley Davidsons in the back." She took another quick glance and grimaced as if to say, "No, you can't have one." "Where on earth y'all find an outfit like that?"
"I built most of it myself," I said.
"Y'all built it y'allself?" He turned to the T-Bird again. "He built it himself, Mama."
This time she didn't even bother to look.
"You want to see inside?" "Does a damn snake sleep lying down? Hell yes."
He lurched towards the rear of Zelda and leaped inside before I pulled out the step.
"Would y'all look at that?" he said in a breathless tone. "Y'all got a stove and a sink and a Frigidaire and a great big old radio. Man, oh man, this is the only way to go. I sure wish Mama had come look at this thing."
He leaned out the back and yelled,
"Hey, Mama, come look at this thing. It's got a kitchen nicer than yours."
Then he turned back to me and said,
"They's one thing for certain."
"What's that?" I asked.
"This sure ain't your daddy's mobile home." "So where y'all headed?" he asked.
"Alaska."
"Alaska? Lord have mercy, what y'all gonna do up in Alaska?"
"I don't know. Just turn around and come back, I guess."
"Where'd y'all come from?"
"I started out in Colorado, but I just came up from the Florida Keys."
"Florida? Well, I'll be.
He traced the countertop with his finger. I sure wish Mom had come look at this thing. Lord have mercy, what she'd do if I ever drug home something like this. Hey, y'all like Mustangs? He asked.
I like anything with wheels. I had a 66 coupe once.
Well, I got something for you. He leaped out the back, and in a flash, his short little legs carried him to the rear of his T-Bird, and I followed.
He popped open the trunk and pulled out a poster of a Saline Mustang. I was admiring the poster while he leaned in the window and told Mama all about Zelda. She continued to ignore him, so he came back to the poster and started reciting specifications about the Mustang. Then he leaned close and started speaking in confidential tones.
I got half a dozen old Mustangs around the house.
He glanced in the direction of his wife to make sure she wasn't listening.
I got this little 66 convertible at the house. It's a sweet little thing. Mama don't like to ride in it. Ain't got no air conditioner. Mama says messes up her hair with the top down.
He paused. I said nothing. I just watched the wheels turning in his head.
One of these days, I'm going to jump in that little car and drive and drive and drive.
His toothless grin stretched from one ear to the other. Then he tapped the poster.
Y'all can have that.
Oh, I couldn't do that, I said.
Sure y'all could. Go on, take it. It's yours.
He was proud to make such a generous gift, so I graciously accepted it and was trying to think of something to give him in return. Then I thought of my demo tape. The first cut on the tape was called Born with Wheels. I got a Mustang in the driveway gonna fix up someday. Tear it down and build her up a better way. Load her down and gas her up and come what may. Hit the road a-searching for that lost highway. Wheels. I was born with wheels.
That's perfect, I thought. I ran over to Zelda and brought back a tape. Here, I wrote these. I think you'll get a kick out of it.
He delicately handled the tape, turning it in his hand and studying each side.
Y'all wrote these? His eyebrows rounded up.
Yes, sir.
So you're a singer?
No, sir, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I just wrote the songs.
Gary Strait, he read from the tape. You any kin to...
No, sir.
He pondered. Well, it takes imagination to write songs, and I figure anybody driving an outfit like that Peterbilt thought I had plenty of it.
Well, thanks. I hope you're right.
Hey, he yelped. I got something else for you.
He scurried back to his car, opened the trunk, and pulled out a second poster. It was another Mustang, but this one was red.
Here, take this.
No, I couldn't do that. One's enough.
No, y'all take it, he insisted.
Well, I appreciate it. Then I noticed his ball cap was pretty well worn. You wear caps, don't you? He raised his cap to expose a skull that shined like the chrome on his T-Bird.
Can a Ford whoop a Chevy's ass?
I spun around, ran back to Zelda, and grabbed one of my black ball caps that had Born with Wheels emblazoned across the crown.
Here, take this.
Why, I'll be.
Look at this, Mama.
She took a furtive glance. We better call this horse trading square, I said, or I'll be driving that T-Bird to Alaska and you'll be driving my old truck back to South Carolina.
Which way y'all heading now?
I thought I'd go up to my cousin's farm in Kentucky.
Hey, he said enthusiastically, y'all like hot rods?
Well, just the ones with wheels.
Well, y'all ought to head over to Pigeon Ford. That's big hot rod country over yonder. They'd sure get a kick out of seeing that old rig of yours.
Well, I don't know. I'm kind of running behind. I better stay on the big road.
No, sir, he insisted. Y'all got to drive over to Pigeon Forge.
I remembered my impromptu trip to the Peterbilt plant and how well that turned out, so I thought I'd better heed his advice. I pulled out my map and the old man started tracing lines across the page.
See there? Y'all need to get up yonder and Pigeon Forge right here. Ain't no much more than that out of your way.
He held his forefinger and thumb about an inch apart.
Just get on 40 to Asheville and run on over to 19. That'll take you up to 441.
441. The numbers clicked in my head like the combination to an ancient vault. I took a closer look at the map, and sure enough, it was the 441. That glorious two-lane of my youth. I repeated the numbers, and they rolled off my tongue like the title to a three-chord country tune. When I was a burr-headed boy, we rolled along that highway dozens of times during our summer sojourns to the Bluegrass State. Dad rarely came with us. It was usually just Mom and us kids. Years later, my brother and I would travel the same road with our hands at the wheel of our own automobiles, which was usually something sporty like a Mustang or a Malibu or a two-door Buick. We were getting our first taste of freedom on the road.
441 runs north out of Athens, Georgia, then crosses over into North Carolina and into the Great Smoky National Park. It exits the park at Gatlinburg, Tennessee. The drive through the Great Smoky Mountains was always a highlight for me. I enjoyed the winding roads that lay hidden under a canopy of trees and the spring waters that spilled out of rock outcroppings. I was intrigued by the ever-present fog that hung over the mountains and valleys like smoke from a forest fire, which is how the mountains got their name, the Smokies. And, of course, the cool mountain air was a welcome reprieve from the oppressive Florida summers. Last but not least, I loved the soft echo of country music fading in and out from some distant AM station. Every year there'd be a new hit song that we would sing over and over and over again as we rolled along. One year it was Patsy Cline and Crazy. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so lonely. Another year it was Bobby Gentry singing about the day that Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. But my all-time favorite had to be Roger Miller's King of the Road. Trailers for sale or rent, rooms to let 50 cents. We tooled along in our old car, eating bologna sandwiches on Wonder Bread, smothered in mayonnaise and mustard, and piled high with bread and butter pickles. Then we washed them down with lukewarm Kool-Aid from a mason jar. When we weren't singing, we chanted in unison, "Gas and oil, gas and oil." That was the line that Gomer Pyle used on the Andy Griffith Show when someone pulled into his gas station. "Y'all need any gas and oil?" The old stations along 441 were very much like Gomer's, so we always kept an eye out for some gas and oil. Those summer road trips played a role in setting the stage for a lifetime of wandering the highways. I drove Zelda across Highway 19 through Maggie Valley and then over to 441. There I headed north to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, but when I arrived at the gate I was disappointed to see a huge sign declaring, "No trucks." I pulled into the visitor center to ask for permission to drive through the park. However, park ranger had already noticed Zelda coming up the road and she met me at the sidewalk. I thought I was fixing to get reamed for coming this far up the road, but she was very polite and asked if Zelda was a commercial vehicle. I assured her that she was just a big toy. "We don't get too many of these through here," she laughed. "If anyone says anything to you, you just have them give me a call." Next to the visitor center was a farm display that was typical of the early day settlers. When we were kids, it was a big deal for us to stop at the farm for a picnic. When I was down in Dallas earlier this year, my sister, Mary, showed me an old black and white photograph of this very spot and told me a story about the day that it was taken. "We were headed to Kentucky the year before you were born," Mary said. "Mamma was with us, but Dad wasn't. You know Dad, he always had some excuse why he couldn't go with us. Our vacation on the road was his vacation away from us kids. Anyway, we were sitting at one of those picnic tables, and Mom was staring out into nowhere and rubbing her stomach. I must have only been about 5 years old at the time," Mary said. "But I remember asking Mom, 'Why are you getting so fat?' Mom didn't answer, but she looked at Mamma, and Mamma was giving her one of those knowing stares. Then Mamma said, 'Can't keep some things a sacred.'" "You knew?" Mom asked. "Of course I knew. I'm your mama. Y'all don't think I lived on a farm for 60 years without knowing when the cows are fixing to calve. I probably knew for you." Mother acknowledged Mamma's suspicion with a strained smile and a tear. "Y'all told Bob the good news?" Mamma said sarcastically. "Old rooster like Bob Strait ain't gonna think much of getting shut out of the hen house. Besides, he can't hardly feed three young'uns he's got. He ain't gonna care nothing about another one." My sister's story reinforced one of my lifelong beliefs that I was an uninvited guest in my father's house. Therefore, I grew up feeling the urge to leave, and once I did, I never stopped. It's no wonder that many of my fondest memories involve a suitcase and a full tank of gas. After having been granted permission to drive through the park, I was careful to not draw too much attention to Zelda. Zelda had no problem keeping up with the flow of traffic, and I behaved myself most of the way. But evidently, my so-called inner child was struggling to be noticed. I couldn't help letting the Jakes rip, rattle, and snort on the downhill side of the mountains, and I just couldn't resist giving the air horns a few shots in the tunnels. By the time I rolled into Gatlinburg, the low-hanging gray clouds let loose with torrents of rain that buffeted Zelda's windshield. Few things give me as much pleasure as a winding two-lane country road, a hard-driving rain, and some soft country music. That's why God made those things, so even gypsies would have a place to feel at home. I reached I-40 and headed west towards Nashville. I've made a few trips down to Toontown during my not-so-illustrious career as a songsmith. The first time I rolled into Nashville was during the summer of my dog and pony tour. I looked up a couple of cowgirls from Colorado who were in Nashville for fanfare. Fanfare is an event where dedicated fans make a pilgrimage to the country music mecca to pay tribute to their favorite stars. Chris and Lou, not to be confused with Chris Ledoux, were a rare breed of cowgirls because their families actually make a living in the cattle business. The girls spent the day at the fairgrounds meeting and greeting stars before we rendezvoused downtown to search out the honky-tonks where legends were made. The first place we strolled into was Tootsie's Bar and Grill, which is one of the most famous. Many a star of yesteryear hung out in Tootsie's, swilling beer and whiskey and taking turns at the microphone. The walls of the bar are papered with memorabilia, autographed photos, album covers, money, napkins, articles of clothing, and of course the walls themselves were scrawled with names and dates. Many of the names, if not most, were famous, like Willie and Waylon and Johnny Cash and Hank Jr. and Hank Sr. Places like Tootsie's are as much a state of mind as reality. They are mystical places that can't be replaced or duplicated once they fade into history. But if you sit quietly and observe with all your senses and imagination, you might hear Merle Haggard singing, "Are the good times really over for good?" The night we were there, the place was almost empty, even though thousands of country music fans were in town. Most of those fans were at the glitzy new theme parks, hotels, and dance halls. There was, however, a group of rowdy ladies from Minnesota sitting at the table next to us. They were trading dirty jokes and lurid stories about men while washing down their stories with pitchers of beer. A tired-looking middle-aged blonde was tending bar and waiting tables, but she still had plenty of time to nurse a cigarette and watch Wheel of Fortune. The TV was turned down low enough to not compete with a lean, gray-haired cowboy who was performing on a small stage located in the front window. The old cowboy and I were the only men in the bar. Chris, Lou, and I waded through a few pitchers of beer and bantered back and forth with the Minnesota entourage. The singer eased his way through all the old country standards that the small crowd called out. Working Man Blues, Waltz Across Texas, Amarillo by Morning, and I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry. Unbeknownst to me, while I was in the bathroom returning some of my borrowed beer to the landlord, Chris and Lou were conspiring with the singing cowboy to get me up on stage. When I came out of the bathroom, the singer leaned into the mic and said, "Ladies, that tall fellow over there just came out of the heads of Mr. Larry Strait. I understand he'd like to entertain you a spell." When the ladies from Minnesota heard the name, they made the obvious assumption, and a round of applause went up that was far greater than deserved. My protests were ignored, and Chris and Lou persisted by getting behind me and pushing me towards the stage. Even though I had been well lubricated with liquid courage, my sensibilities and self-respect were still intact. However, the applause continued while Chris and Lou herded me onto the stage like a calf going to slaughter. The old cowboy leaned into the mic again and said, "Them cowgirls sure know how to move livestock, don't they?" He laughed, then he added, "Here, you're a songwriter," as he held out his guitar to me. "I can only play two chords, and all I know is three-chord country tunes." The old man sized up the situation like a true professional and said, "Ladies, I'm honored to sit in with Mr. Strait." "Quit calling me that," I mumbled. The old man strummed his guitar, grinned, and said, "Well, it be, cowboy." Besides the fact that I'm not much of a guitar player or singer, the biggest reason I never pursued a country music career is that I could never remember the words to songs. My mind was racing to think of a song that I could remember, but the only thing that came to mind was "Jesus Loves Me." And I'm almost certain that somewhere in the Bible it says, "Thou shalt not sing Jesus Loves Me" in a bar. I considered singing one of my own songs, but there was no way the guitar man could play a song that he'd never heard. Finally, I settled on a Clint Black tune. "Killing time," I mumbled.
Be-diddle down, diddle diddle down, down, be-diddle diddle down. You know that one? He played the notes back to me on the guitar and said, that? Yeah, that's it. Okay. He strung the words out like a song as he started the melody. You were the first thing that I thought of. I slurred into the microphone, but I couldn't think of the next line, so the cowboy leaned over and sang the words in my ear. When I thought I'd drink you off my mind, then my mind went blank, so he whispered another line. When I get lost in the liquor, by then I was completely lost, so he offered one more line. You're the only one I find, but all I wanted to do was find the door. I struggled and strained to match the pitch of the guitar. The blonde at the bar glanced at me, then turned back to the TV. She had seen this scenario one too many times. But the Minnesota ladies were keeping time with bobbing heads and tapping feet. I stared blankly at the mic while the cowboy repeated all the lyrics one by one until we made it to the chorus, which I could remember. So I belted out the line at the top of my lungs. This killing time is a-killing me. Now I was on a roll. The old man strummed the guitar without emotion. The barmaid wiped the bar and watched Vanna White. The Minnesota ladies drank heartily, clapped and cheered, while Chris and Lou laughed hysterically. And somewhere, surely, Clint Black was crying because I was killing his song. Before we left Tootsie's, we signed our names on the wall next to the bathroom while the barmaid looked on disapprovingly. Then we strolled out the door arm in arm, as much out of necessity than anything else. We explored the side streets in search of another landmark lounge, but to no avail. We looked out of place among the punk rockers that were roaming the streets because we were the only cowboys in a sea of pink and green hair. Street musicians sat cross-legged on the sidewalks, playing for tips that occasionally fell into their guitar cases. There was a set of stairs that led to an underground bar, and we decided to check things out. Black lights turned Chris and Lou's white cotton shirts into an iridescent blue, while heavy metal music pounded my head and was turning my stomach blue. Chris went into the ladies' room and saw a drug deal going down. I went into the men's room, and I could have sworn that I saw the ghost of Hank Williams Sr. spiraling down the toilet. We combed the streets again in search of other country fair, but found none, although we did find some other cowboys. They were hanging out in an empty lot between two vacant buildings. I said they were hanging, and I mean that literally. Cheap cowboy hats, torn flannel shirts, designer jeans, and red neckerchiefs dangled from one-dimensional plywood silhouettes that were arranged as though they were dancing. I stood there with Chris and Lou and watched as pierced, tattooed, and spiked punks strolled past the plywood cowboys, and I wrote a verse to a song. I rolled into Nashville, took a look around, decided it wasn't my kind of town. I saw boots and hats, but I didn't see no cowboys. My conscience said, get the hell out of town, boy. The next time I went to Nashville was for a songwriter's seminar and showcase. This time I was armed with a briefcase full of demo tapes, and I had no intentions of singing a note in front of any live human being. I walked into the lobby of the Sheraton Hotel and thought I had mistakenly walked into a casting call for a movie about who's who in Nashville. There was no shortage of boots and hats on this side of town, because everyone in the place was doing his or her best imitation of their favorite country star. At least a half dozen Tanya Tucker clones were wearing tight leather skirts and those cute little dude hats that the Cappuccino Cowboys in Aspen wear. Dozens of bare belly buttons were paying homage to Shania Twain, while flocks of Reba-dos herded themselves through the lobby with flaming shocks of red hair piled up like cornstalks. And there were enough Dolly Parton wigs and boob jobs to outfit a chain of strip joints. There must have been a busload of Alan Jackson pretenders, dressed in jeans with holes in the knees and flowing locks of blonde hair protruding from under their white hats. It was hard to squeeze through the hallways between all the chubby cherubs stuffed into black hats and Mobetta shirts, and you could sew 1,000 sails with all of the starched white shirts hanging on the George Strait impersonators. There was a Neil McCoy clone that had been sewn into a pair of Wranglers,
I had to look twice before I was sure that he wasn't the real McCoy. Another phenomena was the number of folks that had stardom somewhere in their family tree, which gave them an excuse to incorporate a little name-dropping. One guy, whose lineage could be traced back to Travis Tritt, managed to work the name Tritt into every other sentence. "My name is Billy Jobbo Francis Calhoun Tritt. Tritt this, Tritt that, Tritt, Tritt, Tritt." The emphasis was always on the Tritt. Then there were the other unfortunate souls who could claim no familiarity with fame by genetics or by mere resemblance. They were left to their own resources to draw attention to themselves. Among these were the old rock and rollers who never got a record deal in L.A., and the heavy metal headbangers that rationalized that steel, as in steel guitar, was a metal and therefore could be forged into a musical alloy and could be called country. Anything to get a record deal. Of course, there were also the brooding artistic types. They sulked around with an air of superiority, not wanting to associate with any of the grotesque mortals. After all, they were artists, and were not given to pursue such vile interests as fortune and fame, or the occasional BMW. I'm sure they came for the enlightenment. Supposedly, the hotel was teeming with record company gods. Unfortunately, none of the pilgrims knew who the gods were, and none of the gods were considerate enough to wear name tags that said, "Hi, I'm Mr. Big. I can make you rich and famous." The guy sporting a t-shirt and jogging shorts was just as likely to be an executive, as was the fellow wearing a $500 silk suit and Italian shoes. The unenlightened masses were sucking up to anyone and everyone, which made for an annoying slurping sound. However, it didn't take me long to figure out who the real record company gods were. I thought it was rather obvious. They were the only middle-aged white guys who had Hooters girls clinging to their arms. The Hooters girls would giggle and preen every time one of the gods opened their mouths. There's only a handful of things that will get an average-looking, middle-aged man that kind of attention. Two of them are money and power. Everyone I talked to claimed to have a record deal in the works. "Yeah, our people are talking to Garth's people. We've got several good cuts in the can, and they've promised to give a listen." This roughly translates into, "We've got a crummy little demo tape, but if we suck up long enough and loud enough, maybe somebody'll notice." I tried to pick up on the lingo, just in case I ran into anyone who looked important. I got my first opportunity to smooze when I bumped into a guy outside the men's room. He was wearing a silk suit, Italian shoes, and a Hooters girl. "Excuse me," I said. Then he said, "No, excuse me." The Hooters girl giggled because the god had uttered words. Unfortunately, I didn't take into consideration that I had just exited the bathroom, and furthermore, I got nervous and mixed up the syntax of the recording culture lingo. I should have said, "Hey, I've got several good cuts in the can. I was wondering if you might give a listen." Instead, I blurted out, "Hey, I just cut several good ones in the can. Were you listening?" All hope was not lost on one incident. Everyone got a chance to exhibit their talents in showcases that were being held in conference rooms. Songwriters who wanted to demo their songs had their names printed on schedules outside each room. Mine was at 8:30 on Saturday night in the Shenandoah room. I didn't want to look like a superstar lookalike, but unfortunately, my good Wranglers had already been washed and pressed. My best shirt was starched to military perfection, and my boots were a brand new pair of Ropers. I was no stranger to these clothes, but I just looked like one of those cookie-cutter cowboys that filled the lobby. I pulled on a pair of worn-out Wranglers, a twill work shirt, a vest, and propped my old straw hat on my head. But before I left the room, I looked in the mirror. I looked like a cigarette advertisement. I tossed the vest and the hat on the bed and took another look. Something was still wrong. It was the boots. Everything I was wearing was old, but my brand new Ropers stuck out like a hood ornament. So I ran down to the truck and grabbed some old work boots that were stained with diesel fuel, smeared with asphalt, and even had some dried road apples stuck to the sole. I ran back upstairs and took another look in the mirror. I looked like a middle-aged truck driver. What the hell, I thought. I am what I am, and I don't give a damn. Many of the performers had show cards with their name on them so that everyone would know who they were listening to. Earlier that day, I ran down to Kinko's and enlarged the cover of my demo tape to 8.5 by 11. Then I dry-mounted the color copy on a piece of foam core. The cover was a silhouette photo of a truck with Born with Wheels scrolled across the bottom. I walked in the conference room and took a seat next to a woman wearing Wranglers and a painted desert shirt. We listened to several songwriters. Some of them performed live, others used demo tapes. Most of them were pretty bad, but a few of them were pretty good. As a matter of fact, a couple of the songwriters were outstanding. And a small part of me wanted to take my demo tape and run for the door. Next to the stage sat Mr. Big, wearing his silk suit and his Hooters girl. Along with him sat a well-dressed middle-aged woman whose last facelift had left her looking a little bit uptight. I assumed from her demeanor that she was a record executive, therefore making her Ms. Big. The rest of the room was filled with superstar lookalikes. The most prominent one was a George Strait clone named Chance. Mr. Big and Ms. Big critiqued most of the songwriters and offered words of encouragement. Mr. Big insisted that everyone needed to learn to express themselves more eloquently. He closed his eyes and delicately touched his index finger and thumb together and recited poetry. When he finished, he took a deep breath, opened his eyes, and said, "That is unforgettable." I'd repeat the unforgettable poem, but I forgot it. The Hooters girl squirmed with pride, however, but no one else seemed all that impressed. A sullen, artistic-looking kid, wearing Levi's and a tailored shirt with the sleeves rolled up, took the stage and quietly introduced himself as Spencer. Spencer was in his 20s, but he had a shy, boyish appearance. He was wearing an expensive cappuccino cowboy hat, and his wire-rimmed glasses did little to mask his swollen eyes. He sang a long, drawn-out ballad about his inner child, and Ms. Big almost had a cow. She made a huge fuss about how well the song expressed the artist's inner being, but I got the impression that Spencer's inner being was pretty well wasted. At first, the young artist was unmoved by Ms. Big's accolades. He was so stoned that I don't think an earthquake would have moved him. His song had so many twists and turns that I needed a roadmap to follow it. I leaned over to the cowgirl sitting next to me and quietly whispered, "Did you happen to catch what that song was about?" She shrugged and said it was something about discovering his inner child or losing it or something. The young man played another depressing tune, and Miss Big almost cried. I didn't quite understand that one either, so I leaned over to the cowgirl next to me. "Did you happen to figure that one out?" "No," she said, "but I got so damn depressed that I wanted to run into the bathroom and slip my damn wrist." Miss Big calmed herself down, and the artistic young fellow seemed to be warming up to her. He set his glazed eyes on Ms. Big and sang his final song as though she was the only person in the room. Maybe they had bonded on another plane, or perhaps she wanted to bond with him on her private plane. Either way, he finished the song, and I thought they were going to have to carry Ms. Big out on a stretcher. I raised an eyebrow to the cowgirl, and she knew what I was going to ask. "I don't have a clue," she grinned. "I think it had something to do with whales." Ms. Big pulled herself together and turned to the audience and said, "I hope all of you were paying attention. This young man has talent." "He's also got a new mother," the cowgirl grimaced. Ms. Big slipped Spencer her card and said, "Spencer, you need to get together with Chance. He needs some original material." "He also needs a life," the cowgirl said. "That'd be a show and a half. A George Strait clone singing songs about saving whales. What about saving some cowboys?" "I think Miss Big needs to talk to her therapist about Spencer. Spencer needs a Prozac and a six-pack, and Chance needs to give up on the George Strait routine." Mr. Big turned to the audience and said, "Next?" "I guess that's me," I said to the cowgirl. "Ride 'em, cowboy," she said. Not wanting to be intimidated, I strolled to the front of the room and handed Mr. Big and Miss Big each a copy of my tape, with no more excitement than I would have had handing 50 cents to a 7-Eleven clerk for a pack of gum. I propped the Born with Wheels show card against my open briefcase and invited the audience to help themselves to a tape. Ms. Big took one look at the truck on the show card and said, "We don't do truck driving songs." "They're not truck driving songs, they're road songs." She shrugged and plunked the tape into the machine and stabbed the play button. Two hard shots from a snare drum led off the first song.
I was born in the summer of 55 in the backseat of a taxi, couldn't wait to arrive. The driver said, lady's got a fever in his eyes, he'll always be a leaving, see you later, bye. Wheels, I was born with wheels.
Ms. Big stabbed the fast-forward button before the chorus was over.
We don't do truck-driving songs, she sneered.
While the next song was queuing up, I couldn't help but wonder, if Miss Big despised truck drivers so much, how did she think her superstar recording artist equipment got from one concert to the next?
First time I saw her doing 90 mile an hour, cruising down a narrow two-lane country road. I pulled up my horse and said, look at that Porsche and that long-legged cowgirl sitting in the seat. I said, hey there, pretty baby, I'm looking for a lady to saddle up a stud and take him for a ride. She said she liked long.
Everyone in the room was smiling and seemed to be enjoying the song until Ms. Big stabbed the fast-forward button.
I can't stand songs about long-legged cowgirls.
Ms. Big glared at Mr. Big, who squirmed and glanced at the long-legged Hooters girl sitting next to him while the fiddle part was queuing up for the next song.
Don't stand there all alone, looking so lonely. Come, pretty girl, won't you dance with me? Take a little trip across the Florence Sea. I'll redefine the word called ecstasy. I don't have special lotion or a magic potion. I'm telling you, girl, it's all in the motion. Hey, call me the wizard, call me the wizard, call me the wizard of Oz. Well, it's not O-Z like the old story, but it's A-H-S like your fantasy. I don't have a pointed hat or a magic wand. I got some moves that'll turn you on. I got my robes and wranglers and an old straw hat. I'm dead.
Most of the people in the room were tapping toes and keeping time with the music. But Miss Big stabbed the button even harder than before.
I hate songs with catchy phrases.
I thought they were called hook lines, I said. Isn't that how half the songs in Nashville get on the radio? The fiddle part on the next intro began. This one was a slow, easy ballad.
From the coast of California to the hills of Bangor, Maine, I'll push this rig across this land, bring it back again. From the lakes of Minnesota to the Gulf of Mexico, doesn't matter when or where or how far.
This time she stabbed the eject button so hard that she jammed the machine.
I said we don't do truck driving songs.
She ripped the tape out of the machine and almost threw it at me. America loves the road, I protested. What the hell's wrong with a road song? Miss Big leaned around me and yelled into the audience,
next!
At least listen to the last song, I persisted.
It's a whiny-ass politically correct ballad. It's even depressing. Trust me, I can get just as depressed as the next guy.
Miss Big stood up and yelled,
next!
I hope you enjoyed part two of Straight from the Road. Look for part three at truck stops nationwide, or send a check or money order for $5 to High Plains Publishing, 712 Winchester Drive, Fort Collins, Colorado, 80526.